This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Northern Kentucky University Regents Professor Bob Wallace will set sail this summer aboard the Charles W. Morgan, America's oldest remaining commercial ship. And he joins us with some history of our maritime past, a preview of his upcoming adventure, and what he and his fellow voyagers hope to learn. And you can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Bob, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Pleasure to be here.
Tell me some of the history of the Charles W. Morgan. This sounds fascinating. This was actually used for whaling from the 19th century into the first half of the 20th century?
Yes, it was launched in 1840, and it had 37 voyages until a hurricane took it out. And so that's a very long run for a whaling ship. So it's nice to be sailing on what they call a lucky ship. And it came out right after the ship Melville sailed on the Acushnet. So they're more or less sister ships built in the same city with the same design and all of that.
So it's called the lucky ship because?
Well, a lot of ships don't make it back from the South Seas. Well, it finally was taken down by the hurricane, but it was lucky for the first 37 voyages it had. Those voyages took 3 to 4 years often out into the Pacific and back. So it had a very long history for a whale ship.
And it's been restored today. In fact, it's what, part of the National Historic Registry, is it?
That's right. It's been at the Mystic Seaport in Connecticut. And they have had it there as a floating museum for about 20 years, but they got the idea to make it seaworthy and take it out on the ocean again. So that's what's happening for the first time this summer.
Wow. Now, how big of a ship are we talking here?
About 110 feet long. And I think the mast is up 110 feet, and it's got a ton of sails on it. And it's a good size ship. It carries a crew usually of about 38, and we'll have a crew that will sail the ship, and then 7 of us will be coming along as the extra voyagers to document the voyage.
And so there is this tie to Herman Melville and the classic novel Moby Dick, because this is the sister ship. And Melville actually sailed on that sister ship, right?
He sailed on the Acushnet about 6 months before the Morgan made its first voyage. So he was out on the ocean. He didn't come back to New Bedford, the city he sailed from, because he skipped ship. He mutinied and ended up having some adventures in Hawaii and Nuka Hiva, and then came back as a sailor on the U.S. United States on a frigate and landed in Boston. So I get to sail back into New Bedford on a whale ship, which an experience he did not have.
So his adventure on that ship was his inspiration for Moby Dick?
Absolutely.
Now, and then there's a Moby Dick connection that you went into when you applied, when you made your proposal for this trip, isn't there?
That's right. I'm an expert, I guess you could say, in Moby Dick, and I've taught the book for now almost 40 years at NKU. And it's a wonderful book to teach because it changes every year, every generation of students. People see different things in it. Every time I read it, I find new things. So to actually, after having lived with the book, almost memorizing parts of it for all these years, to actually be on a whaling ship of the kind that Melville experienced will be extraordinary.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Bob, this was quite an accomplishment, wasn't it, considering that when you put in that application, you were actually competing with, what, hundreds of other people?
Yeah, there were about 300 people who applied, and they asked for people in all sorts of disciplines. So there would be educators, scientists, artists, writers, teachers, people who can document the voyage in various ways. So there will be some publications, some artworks, some public programs afterwards. So to be part of such an interdisciplinary group is very exciting.
You know, this is, you feel like this has been something you've been preparing for all your life. I think that's what I read in the application that you sent. Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, as a teacher of Melville, but I've also spent a lot of time in New Bedford. We established the Melville Archive and Cultural Society in New Bedford 10 years ago that's affiliated with the Whaling Museum. So I go there twice a year with 6 other Melville people to establish programs there. So I'm through that incredible museum in New Bedford, I've learned a tremendous amount of about the history of whaling that I would have never known from teaching it here in Northern Kentucky. And then earlier in my life, in high school, I grew up on Puget Sound, north of Seattle, and I worked on the tugboats for 6 summers. So I really got the salt in my blood at that time, and it's very exciting to be returning to my youth in that sense.
So you've been a seafarer yourself at one point in your life.
I have been, and living on boats with mariners is a wonderful experience.
Any concerns about getting your sea legs back once you get on this trip?
Well, we'll see what happens. The first night in rough weather was tough when I was in high school, and hopefully we'll have enough wind to blow the ship. And I think the big question is whether I can climb all the way to the masthead. I'll be 70 years old this summer. I'd like to give it a shot. They have a little item in the instruction saying that will be up to the discretion of the captain. So we'll see what the captain, I'm sure they know who's able to go up there or not, but I would love to get up there.
But they'll actually let you, climb the masts on this thing if they
Possibly,
think you're
yes.
able to.
Yes.
Are you looking forward to maybe getting a chance to do something like that?
Oh, I'd love to do that. I mean, the masthead's very important. Ishmael's up there at the top of the masthead and just sees the world as a whole the way he never has before. In Jake Hagee's Moby Dick Opera, which is coming to Cincinnati in 2016, there are two wonderful masthead arias where Queequeg and the Ishmael character are singing a duet from opposing mastheads. So really, I've got to be up on a masthead, see what that would feel like.
There's that whole Moby Dick connection again.
That's right.
When you were working at sea, what was that life like?
Well, I worked for 3 years in the harbor, 8 to 8 hours a day, depending on the tides. And then for 3 years, I worked out in Puget Sound, 15 days on and 15 off. So the one experience prepared for the other. I liked the 15 on and off. I had the mate's watch. I worked from noon to 6 and then from midnight to 6. So during that midnight watch, you're just alone with another person you've never met before for 15 days, and you get to know them very well. And one of the things that was so amazing was to watch the sunrise and realize it takes about an hour and a half for the sun to rise. All these beautiful, subtle distinctions of light on the Puget Sound water, and then Mount Rainier, Mount Baker make themselves known. And just from watching the sensations of nature out in that space where you have nothing else to do was extraordinary. And that prepared me to love Turner's paintings, which I'd never seen as a high school kid, but he's a painter who caught all those nuances and gradations of things, and Melville did that too. So Melville had such an ability to capture these sensations of both human and natural life. So to be on an actual whaling ship and feel the spatial sense of that, how much size it has and how it floats through the water and the sky, that will just allow me to appreciate what Melville achieved in Moby Dick in a brand new way.
Is the Charles W. Morgan going to be under pure sail power on this trip?
I think it is. I understand tugs will be available. That may be for getting in and out of the docks, which may not be equipped exactly as they were in those days, but I believe the voyage itself will be under sail.
Now, where will you be going exactly on this trip?
Well, there are about 10 legs of the voyage with different extra voyagers on each one. And the leg I got, it was my preference, and I'm just thrilled to have gotten it. I will board the ship at Martha's Vineyard, and then we will sail into New Bedford.
And how long will that take?
It's going to be a night and a day. Each of these legs, each new group will be on for one night and a day while the main crew goes to all of the stops.
What kinds of things will you be doing on this voyage?
Well, I'll be getting to know my crew members, and I'll be getting the feel and the look of the ship. And then just being open to the sensations of being on the ship and feeling how it moves through the weather. But then the other thing is just the many associations of what whaling used to mean when this ship was out killing whales, and what it means now as such an ecological focus for how we need to understand the world we live in now and prepare for the future. I think being so immersed in those questions intellectually and as a teacher, it's just going to be amazing to see what floods through my mind and those of my fellow Voyagers.
Now, fellow Voyagers, how many other fellow Voyagers and what kinds of people? Who are they?
Well, so far I've just seen an email list, but I know there's of the seven people, I know five of them, and I'm very excited. One is Peter Gansevoort, who is a direct descendant of Herman Melville on the grandmother's side. And then we have Vanessa Hodgkinson, who's a young visual artist from London who has already done some Moby Dick work and has some great plans for the future. I hope we might get here to Cincinnati in 2016 when the opera comes, because I'm going to curate some exhibitions in relation to that. And then we've got Michael Dyer, who I know from my work in New Bedford. He is the top whaling librarian in the world. We have 300 logbooks at the New Bedford Whaling Museum, and like he knows them all. So this is a man who knows more about the history of this ship and like ships than anyone else. And then Mary Kay Burkaw is one of my colleagues at the New Bedford, the project that we have at the archive in New Bedford. And she is a Melville scholar whose high school experience was to sail around the world with her family. She did that instead of going to high school. And she has done the most research among Melville people into his whaling life. So this is going to be a hearty, very knowledgeable crew, and we're going to have a heck of a time.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a great opportunity, just a golden opportunity to have a lot of fun and experience some very neat things. 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. Once you get back, Bob, what are you going to do with all this?
Well, we had to propose a project, in our application. So I'm going to write about the experience. I'll be taking photos during the voyage. I'll be keeping a journal. And then I'll write probably what we call these days a creative nonfiction essay, where it'll be based on the experience, but it will involve these other kinds of associations I expect to have. So I think out of this one day, there's going to be a lot to write about in terms of the people on the ship and the history of the voyage and then the raw experience itself. So that's the first thing I'll be doing, is submitting an essay as my contribution to documenting the experience. And of course, I'll be bringing it back to my students at NKU. I teach Moby Dick and the Arts every other year. And then there's likely to be some public programming involved from the people on the voyage. And I also, because I'm curating some exhibitions having to do with Moby Dick, I expect that some of that will play out over the next 3 or 4 years after the voyage.
Teaching Moby Dick all these years, you know, you run into students who, they share your passion for it, and then you run into some students who, I have to confess, Moby Dick was just, I missed it. I missed it for whatever reason. You run into kids who don't share that same passion. They might even hate the book. Do you have success teaching this, getting kids to, you know, to appreciate the book at some point?
Yes, but I have to say, the first time I read it, I was in your camp. I read it in 11th grade, and the teacher tried to push it too hard, and I didn't like it at all. I did not like the book until college, and I think, unfortunately, a lot of people have that experience. It's forced on them in a way that is not enjoyable, and they never go back to it. On the other hand, a lot of people have that experience early in life and then come back and find that there's a lot in the book that they didn't imagine, including a lot of humor in the beginning. And I think that it all depends on how you approach it. And one thing I like to do when I teach the book now, of course, it's usually upper division students who volunteered for a course in Moby Dick and the Arts. So it's somewhat of a self-selecting group. But I like to, when we first read through the book early in the semester, have them keep a journal or a log in which they record their response to the book itself. So rather than telling them the whole history of how 1,000 people have interpreted the book, it kind of forces them to find their own way through it. And I find that everyone does manage to do that.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And let's talk with Roger. Good afternoon, Roger.
Good afternoon. Well, this is fantastic. Not only am I right in the middle of Moby Dick, which, as your guest says, changes every time, but I was aboard of the Morgan in 1947.
You wow.
can still smell the Parmesetti in her.
Well, that's very exciting. Do you live in Cincinnati?
No, I live in Casstown.
Where's that?
But Casstown is about 8 miles east of Troy. But I'm glad they're going to have tugs with you. I'm sure they have pumps in her. And I'm certain that they will know when to take in sail.
Yeah, I trust...
Go ahead.
I trust that they know what to do. I'm not worried about that at this point.
Good, because I just finished reading a book called The Gathering Wind about the loss of the Bounty.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, my suggestion to you is, if you're going aloft, use the lubber hole.
All right.
And with that, take care.
Thank you, Roger.
So much.
We appreciate it. Also, let's talk with Margaret in Western Hills. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good, thank you.
Good. What's your comment?
Well, I simply want to tell the gentleman how much I'm appreciating what he's saying, but when he said about the time they're going to be out, I was on a 96-foot square rigger on a cruise in the Bahamas back when we were in our 20s, and he and I are the same age. And ever since then, I have never had a vacation, no matter where or when, that ever compared with that. To begin with, the ship was at one time owned by the Vanderbilt family, and there were only 26 passengers, myself and a friend and whatever, and the crew. And we left from Miami, and we went down into the Bahamas, had a great time. We ran into a couple of days that were really very, very stormy. We had to put on the lifeline, and I've got pictures of the broken top mast, and we had to spend an extra day, tra-la, in Nassau getting that fixed. But we had to get on and off of the ship from a dory because they were never able to pull in close to the land. And even these little experiences, climbing up and down the ratline from the ship to the dory and sailing on the ship itself, was just so fantastic. And at that time, that was really a rare experience. And I often wished that there was someplace closer to home beside there. And I don't even know if that company still runs those or not, but our ship was really great, and I really loved it. And when I hear about what you're doing, I'm wishing there was something like that when we were younger. And I congratulate you on what you're doing, and I hope you have a lot of success.
Well, thanks very much for that comment. And a broken topmast is a pretty serious thing, so I'm glad you got through all of that just fine.
Yes, it was a good experience for us, though. We learned a lot about sailing, that it wasn't all easy. You know, and thinking about, as I said later on, we got to think about the people that crossed from Europe to the Americas on that type of ship and everything. It gave us something to think about. And we had our passenger group was more than just Americans. There were people who were not Americans with it, and we got acquainted with them and learned about different things. And the one fellow decided after the cruise he was going to go back to school and study for things to do with the ocean. He was going to go back to Miami and go to the university, and he decided he wanted to do some more underwater study, which was great.
Thank you, Margaret. We appreciate the comment very much.
Yes, well, I'm like I said, I'm enjoying this, and I wish you all a lot of luck, and I wish I could be with you.
Well, thank you so much. I'll be thinking of you, and I hope I don't get quite as violent a weather as you had.
Well, like I said, it was an experience, and I hope you don't either, but if you do, I'm sure it'll be exciting.
Thanks, Margaret. We appreciate it. We got an email from Luke. He's a U.S. history major. He wanted to ask if you know, is it true that the crew with Melville had to repel a cannibal attack during his voyage?
I don't think that exactly happened, but they, you know, there's so much myth about cannibals, it's hard to sort things out a little bit. We do know that Melville first skipped ship at Nukuhiva, where the people were thought to be cannibals, and there were Americans trying to there as missionaries, and he found that these people had a better way of life than he felt Americans did back home, so he was very surprised. The question makes me think of the crew of the Essex the ship that was stove in by a sperm whale in 1819 and left the whole crew in several whale boats. And the most natural way to, for them to survive would have been to follow the winds that went to Nuka Hiva, actually where Melville ended up going lately. But they'd heard about the cannibals there, so instead decided to sail against the wind back to Chile, which was 3,000 miles instead of 1,000 miles. And they ended up having to cannibalize each other on the way home to survive. So there's so much myth, but also strange history about cannibals. And I don't remember hearing about Melville's ship actually being attacked by cannibals.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation, or you can always email us at talk@wvxu.org. Do you plan to do more writing or picture taking? Do you have any ideas yet as to how you're going to approach it?
Well, I'll be doing both. I think with writing a journal, it's important to do some of it in the moment and just see what comes in. The pictures, I'll obviously take as many as I can while I'm there because you can't repeat that experience. So I think they're both kind of equally important to be able to see how tall that mast looks when you're right under it, or how small the ship looks when you're up high. You can't, the cameras can be very helpful to capture that, and my shipmates and all that. But I think the personal act of writing about something while it's happening, just trying to be open to the whole dimension of the experience is a very exciting thing to do. And I kind of see this as a very high adventure from that point of view as a writer.
Do you think this is going to give you a better appreciation of what Melville went through and of Moby Dick in general?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just to be on that kind of ship and to sail into the waters that he sailed out of, and to be with an amazing bunch of people. You know, I don't know this crew. He didn't know. I know a few of them. I don't know the people who are actually sailing the ship. I'm very interested in seeing the people who today know how to sail 19th century whale ships. These have to be some incredible people, the captain and the mates. And I'm very interested in getting to know them and seeing how they've managed to learn all that it takes to recreate that maritime experience. So I think I'll be learning from them, as well as from, you know, bringing to life what I've studied in the libraries and as a teacher.
We were talking earlier about how they're probably going to use a lot of sail power on this trip. For the most part, are they sailing this the way traditional sailors and navigators did it, or is there some aspect of technology involved in getting this sailing ship around?
You know, that's something I haven't learned yet. I'm guessing they do it by hand the way it was done then. But we're going to have a training session on April 26th. I'm going to go to Mystic, and we'll find out all of that. We'll get to see the forecastle where we'll be sleeping. We'll find out how they use their modern knowledge to operate a 19th century sailing ship. But I'm guessing it'll be with the same kind of manpower that was done then, without extra physical leverage.
Do you know if these are volunteers of Mystic Seaport, or is this a full-time crew that's doing this?
I'm not sure. This is they must have assembled. They must have. Maybe it's like a great pickup orchestra in New York City, where they have some big occasion come, and they have some stalwarts who are there as the corps and bring some extras in. But they really haven't told us anything about that element of the voyage yet.
I think you're right. I think that this would have to be some people who are really good at seamanship to be able to pull this off with a vessel like this.
I'm sure.
Is Moby Dick, is it still a relevant book these days in terms of understanding the natural world and traditions of the old?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the strongest interpretive angles on the ship is what we call the ecofeminist angle. And this is a movement in literary criticism that is all about the ecology of our relationship to the natural world. And Melville's novel in the, say, 1950s was read as kind of man against nature, Ahab conquering the whale and all of that. But at the deeper level of the book is all about understanding whales. And all those chapters that adventure people don't like about the head and the eye of the whale, they show Melville's deep interest in this living creature and in the life we share with it on the planet. So there's a chapter, Will the Whale Diminish? He wonders, in the middle of writing the book, whether we will destroy whales the way we've destroyed buffalo. So today, that is one element of the book that is just absolutely in line with our current interests. And I guess another very strong element is, as our caller mentioned with her voyage in the Bahamas, Melville's ship was, and Moby Dick itself, was full of people from all over the world. Each of these whaling voyages was essentially a global society that was there assembled for the purpose of the voyage. And that book, starting with Queequeg, the great Polynesian harpooner, is all about multicultural collaboration and appreciation. And we certainly need that more today than ever. And in reading Moby Dick, you know, Queequeg was not very important in the 1950s, or Pip, the black cabin boy. But now the way people read the novels and the way they interpret it, like in Hagee's Moby Dick opera that's coming, Queequeg and Pip, the Polynesian and the black teenage cabin boy, are extremely important characters in the opera. So that global vision that Melville had and his ecological vision of the rhythms of nature that we need to reestablish are two of the major challenges facing people today.
Thank you, Bob. Appreciate you joining me this afternoon. Northern Kentucky University Regents Professor Bob Wallace, he'll be sailing this summer aboard the Charles W. Morgan, America's oldest remaining commercial ship. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's program, Pete Reitmeier, and the technical director, Bruce Ellis. I'm Mark Haney.